Good morning, everybody. Dr. Ben Edwards here with You're the Cure. Thank you for joining us again today, and I'm super excited. We've got Dr. John Day with us. He is the author of The Longevity Plan, and I know if y'all are long-term listeners, you've heard me speak about Dr. Day and his book, The Longevity Plan, and quote from it many, many, many times. I keep it on my desk in my office, and pretty much every single patient I see, I refer to this book, I believe, because as the name of the show implies, you are the cure. It's your diet and your lifestyle and you know, the way you live, the amount of stress you have and what you put in your mouth and all these things outside of the genes that actually impact our health the most. And Dr. Day's book really drives that home. So that's why I love it so much. It just lines up with our philosophy and the way we practice here at Veritas. So Dr. Day, thank you. Welcome to the show and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ben. It's an honor to be on your show today.
Well, I like to start with all my guests really, as much as you're willing to or want to share some of your personal story. You're a cardiologist. You practice in New York, right?
You're halfway right. Okay. I am a cardiologist, but I also, my area of expertise has to do with abnormal heart rhythms of the heart. So hearts that beat too fast, too slow, too irregular. And my practice is in the Salt Lake City area of Utah.
Okay. Sorry. I don't know why I said New York. But beyond that, just some of your background, your training maybe, and then what led you to the point of writing the book really is what we want to know. Most cardiologists and especially specialists of fast heartbeats are very, very busy doing lots of cardiology things and don't have time to write books, much less go on trips to China. So maybe give some of your background, what led you up to writing the book?
All right. Well, you know, this is something we never set out to write a book. And in fact, if my high school English or writing teacher ever saw that I wrote a book, she'd probably be absolutely, turn in her grave that I amounted to something, because that was not my area of focus. I always wanted to be a doctor from the youngest age, and that was my sort of focus on life, and that was the direction I wanted to go. After graduating from college, I did my medical school training at Johns Hopkins, and then following medical school at Johns Hopkins, did my internship, residency, cardiology fellowship, and then an additional fellowship in cardiac electrophysiology at Stanford University. And then following Stanford University, I accepted a faculty position at the University of Utah Medical School, and after a few years then transitioned over to Intermountain Healthcare, which is one of the largest nonprofit healthcare delivery systems in the U.S., and I've been practicing there as an electrophysiologist, cardiologist, and yes, you're absolutely correct. It is a very, very busy profession, and there's so much going on, and there's a lot of call duties and others, so writing a book was never on my to-do list. However, when I got into my mid-40s, and oftentimes we see this, people think they're doing well, they think they're healthy, and then suddenly in their 40s or somewhere around there, a lot of times their bad habits all catch up to them. And that's what happened in my case. I was always an avid exerciser, but my diet was awful. Stress levels were horrible. Sleep was like a luxury, which unfortunately in my profession is often the case. And little did I know, all of a sudden, now I'm finding myself wondering if I need to go on disability. It hurts too much to exercise. I can't even I can't even do my job. And my job is one where we have to wear a heavy lead suit when we're doing procedures and surgeries. And my back and spine would hurt so much. Had an autoimmune disease, ankylosing spondylitis, eosinophilic esophagitis. I was overweight, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, chronic insomnia. I mean, the list just goes on and on. And it was about this point that I said, something has to change. And yes, you know, I did the traditional route, taking medications, prescription medications that would help with the symptoms, but it wasn't getting better. And for people who know me or followed our work or have read the book, know that I do speak fluent Chinese. I actually majored in Chinese before medical school. And as part of a leader in our medical societies, the cardiac medical societies, I was often asked to speak at the big conferences in China. I think they liked the fact that I was one of the few Caucasians that could give my cardiac lectures and do the Q&A in Chinese. And so I kept getting invited back, and my colleagues, the physician colleagues in China, shared with me about this longevity belt in China in the Guangxi province, where they have the highest longevity rates, life expectancy in China. And in particular, there's a county in China called Bama County. And at the epicenter of this this longevity belt in China, where there's a higher percentage of centenarians than anywhere else in the world, this longevity village, that not only do they live these long lives, but they're incredibly healthy. They're not on medications. They don't have all these doctor visits. And they're still physically active, not hurting, doing everything they used to do at a younger age in their 100 plus. And so hearing this, really, as I shared it with my wife and our family, we felt like this was our family quest to try to see, is there a different way to live? And so when we went, traveled here to this village, not only was it a personal quest, but it was also one for my patients, because as a physician who specializes in heart rhythm abnormalities, and probably the main thing that I treat in my practice is a condition called atrial fibrillation, where the heart beats irregularly, it can lead to strokes and heart failure and other problems. But interestingly, as I looked at it and was increasingly frustrated that medications and procedures weren't working as well as I would like, is that atrial fibrillation, by and large, probably 80% of the cases are lifestyle related. And so it was a quest for me, and it was a quest for my patients to look for a better way, a more permanent solution.
Okay, that's awesome. So how old were you at the time when you, all these different diagnoses and prescription medications you were on, when you reached this point of thinking about,
you know,
looking at this?
It's the old proverbial, you hear people, you know, I turned 40 and everything happened. It really seemed to hit about 1 week before I turned 40. But it just progressed. And for me, this rock bottom where I was contemplating, do I need to go consider medical disability because I'm no longer able to wear this lead suit and do these procedures and that, by about my mid-40s, about 44. And so it had progressed from the right around age 40 to 44. And that's when, you know, feeling that way, I'm thinking, I'm only 44 and I feel horrible. What's it going to be like when I'm 54 or 64? Is there even going to be a golden years for me in my future? And something had to change.
Right. So you're in the mid-40s, thinking about disability, multiple diagnoses, on medications, conventionally trained as I was. So the mindset is these diseases just kind of came on me, and these medications are not really doing enough. Something's got to give. Was it just the colleagues in China talking about this longevity village that caused you to maybe connect those dots? How much did you know diet and lifestyle maybe was at the very root of these diseases? I always put diseases in quotes because really I think they're consequences. But for a conventionally trained doctor, it seems like a tough leap for us to make from these diseases that can only be treated with drugs to, wait a minute, maybe there's a diet and lifestyle thing. So was it just the longevity discussion with the colleagues in China, or did you have some other background in natural medicine or diet, or were you predisposed to be open-minded to diet and lifestyle?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And at least in my personal case, I was in a sense of denial. I did not have any training in nutrition or any of these other areas. I had the usual curriculum in medical school, and I'm trying to think back, you know, maybe there were a couple of lectures we had on diet and nutrition and sleep and optimizing stress levels, but I don't recall too many in my medical school classes, you know, at least in the 1990s at Johns Hopkins, and perhaps your training was a little bit more enlightened than my training was. So there really wasn't a whole lot of it there, and I was in denial. I guess I had this crazy idea that as long as I exercised, I was healthy. And so I was a lifelong, very physically active person. But then, like I said, when I hit my mid-40s, I quickly learned that you can't out-train a bad diet. And it all caught up to me. And then I got to the point where I was no longer able to exercise. And that's when things really started to deteriorate quickly. But I had this sense of denial that as long as I was exercising, you know, it was okay if I was eating junk. I was busy, you know, the bagel, the donut, the Diet Cokes, the slice of pizza for lunch, thinking that, you know, as long as I'm exercising, everything will equal out okay, and I'll be all right in the end. You know, I'd see my colleagues do the same thing, and I'd look at them, and, you know, they looked okay, so I figured I was okay, but I wasn't okay.
Right.
So to answer your second part of your question, to be open-minded about this, I think for me, for most people to really open your eyes, you really have to get to the point where you realize that you've got no other options. At least that's how it was in my case. The medications just made me feel worse, and I could see things deteriorating. And so by necessity, I had to be open-minded. And with my colleagues, they had shared in China, they had shared with me about this place, but there wasn't a whole lot more to it. And I think for me, it was kind of that adventuresome looking for, you know, answers. You know, let's go into the rural backwoods of China. I speak Chinese. My wife is a very adventurous traveler. And it was like one of those things that's like, well, what do you have to lose? Let's go see if there's something there. And it was through this 5-year experience where we would take our family on, you know, every vacation break, summer breaks here, there, where we would go and spend time with the people. I had a research team there on the ground doing all the genetic studies and looking at it, even from a scientific standpoint, as I looked at the genes of these people, they were predisposed to get cardiovascular disease, diabetes, dementia. Their genes were no better than ours. But yet in looking at them, it's, what is different? Why are they living 100 plus, many of them 100 plus, without all these chronic diseases that I see every day in my practice? And so it really opened up my eyes to these epigenetic factors. Yes, we're dealt the genes that we are dealt with. However, our daily decisions that we make can help to determine, to a large part, which genes are turned on and which genes are turned off. And so seeing the science in front of me, having to go there and experience it myself, do the research myself, really convinced me, even with my, you know, Western medicine scientific training, that something was missing to the puzzle. And that's what led us on this quest.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I can tell you my training was not more enlightened than yours. At UT Houston, I graduated in 2002, and I've had to think back, and I think it's about 2 hours, maybe 3 hours of nutrition lectures I got in medical school. I do remember an elective lunchtime series put on by a cardiologist, actually, and it was all about diet and reversing cardiovascular disease. But it was an elective lunchtime only, and I showed up because there was free pizza. And I think
free pizza at a nutrition.
Yeah. So there were about 12 or 15 of us out of 200 in the class that showed up. And I distinctly remember his perfusion scans that he put up pre and post diet change, and it was amazing. And I actually asked the cardiologist, why are you on the elective lunchtime series and not the main circuit on our main curriculum? And his answer was mostly related to financial, that procedures paid well and diet didn't. But also, which I think that's definitely plays a part, and we don't need to get into that necessarily, but you touched on the fact that you had to basically get to this point of desperation. There's no other options. I'm so desperate, I've got to consider other things. And I think that's where about 98% of the patients that we see in our functional medicine practice, they come see us out of that same desperation. And it's, discouraging to me that we can't do a better job of getting upstream 5 or 10 years or 20 years, or even all the way up to our children, you know, children's ages, where we can teach the truth about diet and lifestyle so we can avoid these things. But we're human. I think human nature is. especially when sugar's involved, the addictive nature of sugar and convenience in the life we live here in America. So I really, it's a big challenge for Americans and American physicians who do understand nutrition to convince patients to get out in front of this. And that's why I refer to your book so much, because it's just so convincing. So let's go back to, you went to the village. I kind of walked through maybe the first trip or the first few trips when you were just starting to kind of observe and see these centurions. And I'll just have to make this one comment. Some folks that I talk to say, I don't want to live to be 100 or 110 like those China folks in China, because they assume they're going to be sick and in a nursing home that last 10 years, 20 years, whatever. And one of the good points of this book is these guys were up and active. One part of the book, I think you quoted one of these villagers, I believe is a man out in the field working, saying he's in his prime. And he was like 110 years old or something, and he felt like he was in his prime. And that's the point. It's not about just living long, but healthy. It's about living healthy, staying out of the nursing home. So anyways, had to throw that in there. I love that part of the book. But describe to the listeners maybe that first experience, what you first saw in those first few visits to this area of China.
Oh, absolutely. So our first visit was in 2012, so a number of years ago. And that was really more of one of, is this thing for real? Now, there are some publications about this village, this county in China, this longevity belt in the Western medical literature, but most of the scientific publications on this group of people are all in the Chinese medical literature. And so being able to speak and read Chinese, I versed myself in the medical literature that had been published on these people before going there. But going there was really more or less to prove it to myself. Is this for real? And our first experience, of course, it's very difficult to get there. It's in a remote mountainous village. It's multiple transfers on the airplane, bus, finding local villagers that will drive us in. But we were finally able to get there. So it's a several day journey to get there. So you have to really want to go there. But the thing that probably struck me the most, and if you can just picture this is about 50 miles from the Vietnam border in a mountainous area, southwest China in the Guangxi province, like I had mentioned, lush, almost kind of a lush subtropical area. And when we finally get to this village, after several days of travel, you have to cross a river. And there are limited ways you can cross the river. And as you come into the village, probably the thing that was most striking is, at least in the U.S., when you come into a new town, you see the billboards, the young, sexy models, whatever. But that wasn't the case as we came into this longevity village. Rather, there was a billboard with pictures of these centenarians with their life story there. And every year, as a centenarian would pass away or a new one would join the ranks, they would change the billboard. And so it was completely different where age was celebrated. These centenarians were like the rock stars of the village. And in fact, people would come from busloads from throughout China to come to this village and this county in China to try to learn the secrets of longevity, of healthy and long lives. And while I don't think most of them found it, still the thing that was probably most striking is that age was celebrated. And you're absolutely correct. I regularly give talks at medical conferences and other conferences around the world, and especially in the U.S. In the U.S., whenever I ask the audience, how many of you want to live to 100? Maybe a third of the hands will go up. And you're right. It's this people view living to 100 in that they're going to be disabled. They'll be on 20 different medications. Somebody's going to be feeding them. They'll be sitting in a wheelchair. They'll hurt everywhere. But it doesn't have to be that way. These people, every centenarian, every 100% of the centenarians that we met a lot of them, over the 5 years of research that went into this book, not one of them said that their lives were miserable. In fact, every single centenarian shared with us that they were living the very best years of their life, that life just got better. And they were so thrilled to be alive, and they felt so good. They didn't have arthritis. They didn't have cardiovascular disease. They didn't have dementia. They weren't on medications. And so it really challenged me and challenged everything that I had learned at Johns Hopkins and Stanford about what it means to age, and that the body doesn't necessarily have to break down. You can be physically active and enjoy life right up until the end. And most of the villagers, at least historically, now it's changing now, and we discuss this in the book. Unfortunately, the Western lifestyle has found its way even to these remote areas of China. But at least historically, these people would go out, put in a hard day's work in the fields, meet together with their family, neighbors, have fun, celebrating over dinner, and then would just pass away quietly and painlessly in their sleep. And that can be the case. You can enjoy every last breath of life until the very end. The very end doesn't have to be full of disability and suffering.
Yeah, amen. I agree 100%. I remember I used to have a practice in a small town in West Texas, and I was the only doctor in the county, so I took care of all the old folks in the nursing home. When I first got there, which would have been 2005, I remember one old 100-year-old gentleman, and he passed away, so I had to fill out the death certificate, and I just had to put old age, natural cause. I mean, he had no diseases, but that was right. The only one. That was my first year there, and then everyone after that, it was always some various disease, heart disease or dementia or Parkinson's or something. So even in America, it used to be just old age and die in your sleep, but these days not so much. So when you went, was your intent originally, or maybe after the first few visits, to look at the genes and try to prove that maybe they just didn't have the genes for dementia and heart disease and cancer and stuff like that? Or did that come later? Was that a later thought, or was that your initial goal from the get-go?
Well, my initial goal was just to figure out, you know, is everything that I heard true? Can you really have a group of people that can somehow defy the natural consequences of aging? And once I saw that indeed it was true, and all of these scientific articles that have been written about them in the Chinese medical literature were in fact very true, and reviewed the data and went through it myself, then the skeptical side of me, perhaps that Western trained scientific approach to me, said, well, it's got to all be in their genes. It can't be. I mean, this must be some special super group of people that are geographically isolated, and they all possess these super genes so they don't get sick. But it wasn't the case. And it really gave me a lot of hope, because I've gone through that 23andMe, and I've had all my genes looked and analyzed and sent it out for third party to have everything fully interpreted and analyzed. And, you know, I didn't get the best deal in life. And it gave me hope that just because they may have a family history of heart disease or diabetes or obesity, you name it, it doesn't have to be that way. And so that was a really a message of hope from these visits. And what led to this book, as we went through it and looking at it, and when I shared it with my colleagues at the hospital, it was when I shared it with them that my colleague said, you've got to write this up. And that was really the impetus to write this book, is at my colleague's insistence, as I talked at a grand rounds at our hospital of everything we had found from this village. And that's the message. It's a message of hope.
Yeah. That's exactly why we have you on the show today, and why I recommend your book so much, that we're not victims of our genes. Just because your grandmother had whatever, heart disease or dementia or breast cancer, and your mom had it, doesn't mean you have to have it. You may have the genetic predisposition to it, but I describe genes to my patients as just books on a bookshelf. They're there, they're full of information, but they're just sitting there waiting to be read. Somebody has to tell the librarian to go to the second shelf, third book from the right, open up to page 34 and read paragraph 2, and I'll do what it says. And that part, the direction of the librarian to go and read the book, Genetic Expression, is so much influenced by the diet and lifestyle. So you're exactly right. We don't want to be a victim. We are totally in control of these things. We are about at a break point here, Dr. Day. I think it's a good time to take a quick commercial break for our sponsors to get in here, and then we'll come back and dive in more. I want to maybe get into some of the studies that you talk about so much in the book, the differences in disease rates in some of these folks. So we'll go into that and some more. So stick with us. We're with Dr. John Day, and the book is called The Longevity Plan, 7 Life-Transforming Lessons from Ancient China. And we'll also talk about your wife, Jane Ann Day. Forgot to mention her at the top of the show, but our wives always have great insights, too. So I want to definitely get your thoughts on your wife's take on all this, too. So y'all stick with us. We will be right back with You're the Cure. Okay, we are back. Thank you for sticking with us. We are with Dr. John Day, and The Longevity Plan is the name of his book. I highly recommend it. We have it available at our clinic here at Veritas, but also, I'm sure, available everywhere. Outstanding book. You're not a victim of your genes. Diet and lifestyle, also known as epigenetic factors, really direct the expression of those genes. Turning those genes on and off is impacted by the decisions you make every single day, not only what goes in your mouth, and we'll get into this specifically, the other things. Movement is one, a sense of belonging in a community, a sense of purpose, bringing stress levels down. So there's more than just nutrition, although nutrition's big. So be encouraged. You are the cure. Your body has a cure. Your body has been designed to function normally all the days of your life. It doesn't make sense. God would put you on the earth for a set number of days and then give you a body that's going to fail you halfway through that number of days. So we're trying to get our patients' health span curve to match their lifespan curve. We need to extend the health span instead of starting to deteriorate, as Dr. Day said, about age 40. I think the wheels come off and our health curve starts to rapidly decline. It doesn't need to be that way. We can push our health span curve way out there, and hopefully it'll drop off right at the end to match our longevity curve. So, Dr. Day, thank you again for joining us. I want to dive right back into I know the listeners are going to be real curious on exactly what you did see as far as nutrition and hydration and movement. I call it the four pillars: nutrition, hydration, movement, and peace is what we talk about in my clinic, and kind of lines up a lot with your book. And you noted 7 life-transforming lessons, so maybe we can go through some of those if we have time. We'll hit them all, but I know nutrition is always the number one thing people kind of want to focus on. So describe a little bit about what you saw and observed with what these folks were eating in this longevity village in China.
Absolutely. And that's why we put this at the first chapter of our book, is food is so hard for all of us. We touched a little bit on it, the addictive qualities of food. It's so tempting, and it's all around us. In my hospital, all you can eat bagels, cookies, Coca-Cola products are all free for all the physicians in the doctor's dining lounge. And on the nurse's station, there would be cookies, leftover Halloween candy, you name it. And so food is hard for all of us. But that was probably a thing that was most striking about this village, is they ate real food in the areas around there. They didn't have all this processed food, sugar-laden food. In fact, Coca-Cola wasn't even in this village when we showed up in 2012. However, over subsequent visits, even Coca-Cola was able to invade this remote village in the middle of nowhere of China. But the other thing that was probably most striking is that vegetables were served as part of their breakfast. They had vegetables as part of their lunch, vegetables as part of their dinner. Now, it wasn't all just vegetables, but they ate a lot of them in quantities that we would never imagine here in the U.S. And a lot of the vegetables, at least when we look at it, almost look like they were almost weeds that they would, but yet they would able to prepare them in a way that made them very delicious. Fruit was a part of their diet, nuts, seeds, legumes. And in addition to that, they're in this river that we talked about that went through the village. There are these small little fish that are high in the omega-3s, and they would have fish maybe once or twice a week. But as far as animal meat was largely absent from their diet, not because they didn't like it, not because they had some, it was just because they were such poor people and they didn't have access to it. And they had been through years and years of the Chinese Revolution, failed Chairman Mao policies. There was famine. And so any animals or livestock or anything you may have had would have been stolen. And the only food they couldn't steal was the food that came from the ground or they pulled out of the river. But at the time of the Chinese New Year, or if there was a wedding or something like that, then yes, they would enjoy pork. But in fact, they would eat the whole pig, nose to tail eating. So a little bit different than what we would see in the U.S., but probably the most striking thing is sugar was absent from their diet. It's not that they didn't like it. If they wanted sugar, it was about a week's journey round trip through these jungles and this mountainous village to get to a village where they could trade if they even had the money, but they were very poor people. So it wasn't that they didn't like sugar. It wasn't that they didn't like salt. It wasn't that they didn't like all these things. It's just they were such poor people that they didn't have access to it. But, you know, it served them well. And like I mentioned, processed food. When we went there in 2012, we didn't see any processed food. But by our last visit, 5 years later, we started to see processed foods making their way into this village. So they ate real food. And that is absolutely critical. They didn't have all this flour, sugar, all the other stuff, which, as we know, causes so many diseases, cardiovascular disease especially. We're just now learning that how our diet can really impact whether or not our hearts are going to be healthy.
Right. So lots of vegetables, 3 meals a day, occasional fish from the river, and fruits, and you mentioned legumes, beans, but did they have any grains?
There were, of course, this is China, so you have to have rice.
Right,
But the rice, at least historically, wasn't the white rice, which is nothing more than really sugar. The rice they ate, they had to prepare it themselves. And so as such, it was a very coarse rice, like a brown type rice. Minimal. So they would eat the intact grain. And that's something, you know, I share with a lot of my patients is if you're going to eat grains, eat an intact grain, because then you get that slow metabolism. It's not like flour, which is just instantly converted to sugar in the body. So the grains that they did have mostly were these very coarse, minimally processed rice, because they had to prepare it themselves. But being an Asian group, you have to have rice. But it was an intact rice, more of like a brown type rice. Now, of course, things have changed, and they, like everybody else, you know, the white rice tastes a lot better because it's very, you know, it's got such a high, you know, sugar spike to it. So, and that's what they ate from grain, but mostly it was just real food. A lot of nuts, as we mentioned, seeds as well, in addition to what we just covered.
Okay. On the vegetables, was it mostly greens or in the greens family, or did they have root vegetables, or was there much variety of vegetables?
There was a lot of variety. There were greens, tubers, and like I mentioned, a lot of the stuff that, as you look at it, it was green and it kind of looked like a weed, but they would eat it. And that was the beautiful thing. And you're right about variety and that. And one other point is that it was fresh. They would harvest it on the day they would eat it. And so that farm to plate time was, you know, less than 24 hours. But these are all things that we can replicate here in the U.S., whether it's farmers markets, co-ops, or even, you know, heaven forbid, have our own garden where mm-hmm. we can get fresh greens, depending on where you live. Some places may be year-round, other places it may be seasonal, but still to enjoy it when you can. And that was one of the beauties of there is a wide variety. It was a rainbow of colors. There were greens, there were reds, there were yellows. And by hitting on all the colors, you know that you're probably hitting on all of the micronutrients as well.
Right. Did they have any fermentation or any special techniques on the rice in particular, soaking it, sprouting it, or any preparation techniques?
Yes, they did. In fact, they would ferment the rice. And one question that I'm often asked as I speak on this is, what about alcohol? Was that a point there? And these people didn't drink that much. One thing about the Asian population, a lot of them lack the alcohol dehydrogenase gene, and so many of them, if they would drink, would quickly become flushed, and it was a very uncomfortable feeling. And so alcohol wasn't a huge part of their diet. Like I said, a lot of it has to do for genetic reasons and how they metabolize it. But the alcohol they did have was a fermented rice wine, but they would also have other fermented rice dishes. And so there were some of these fermented foods that were part of their diet, and they would even ferment their soybeans and some of these others. And so fermented foods were a part of their diet.
Okay. And you mentioned the climate there, kind of a temperate, tropical, year-round growing is what I'm getting at.
Year round. They had a year round growing season.
Okay. So did you ever see anybody fasting? I mean, I'm sure they wouldn't if unless they just didn't have exposure to food, but fasting's been a big kind of topic. We've had Dr. Jason Fung on the show for Americans in particular. It's a beneficial thing to just not eat sometimes, but was that even a word over there? Did they know about fasting or do any fasting?
That's a great question, and something, it's kind of like exercise. If you ask the people, do you exercise? They kind of give you that deer in the headlights look. Why would I get in a car, drive to the gym, change my clothes, exercise, and then, change back, get in my car, drive. That's such a foreign concept to them because they were physically active all day. And the same is true with fasting. It's not something they set out to do. They didn't do it for religious reasons. They didn't do it for health reasons. They just did it because that's the way they lived and they felt well and they knew what worked for their bodies. But about all of them, well, first of all, snacking was not part of the culture. There was no culture of snacking. You would get up in the morning, you would have your breakfast, you would go out into the fields, and you would work. And as I talked with the centenarians, about half of them would eat three meals a day. Snacking, like I said, was not a part of their culture. But the other half of the centenarians would only eat two meals a day. And once again, there was no snacking. So for the people who did the three meals a day, they would typically have an early dinner, and then they would retire. They would socialize in the evening and then retire and then eat in the morning. And so for the centenarians who were subscribed to the three meals a day plan, they would have periods of intermittent fasting of about 12 hours each night where they'd have a light early dinner and they would not eat again until morning. And typically that was about 12 hours. For the centenarians that were subscribed to the two meals a day plan, then of course they had larger periods of time-restricted feeding. But yet they didn't set out to do this. This was something that just sort of happened accidentally because they felt better this way. This is the way they grew up and they were in tune with their bodies, and that's what they wanted. And I think some of it has to do with food reward, in that so many of the hyper palatable foods that we have in the West, the sense of food reward is so high that of course we want a snack. We want every excuse we can to partake of this. Whereas in their culture, where you didn't have all of this food reward, just because you didn't have all the processed sugary foods, they ate to live rather than living to eat. It was a change in philosophy. And so going 12 hours without eating was just something that came natural.
Right. Yeah, that's awesome. I don't know if that's even possible in America, but we'll get into that later. I want to get through some of these steps and then we'll talk about can we even apply this? How do we apply this in American culture? What about hydration? What kind of things did they drink besides what you've mentioned, the occasional fermented rice wine?
Right. Surprise, surprise, they mostly drank water. Now, this is They were fortunate in that in this mountainous area, there are lots of limestone caves and all of these streams that would just come out of the ground. And so it was naturally filtered, cleaned mineral water. And so they were fortunate. So they had access to clean, healthy, natural drinking water, and they partook in abundance. And so they mostly drank water. Now, of course, being an Asian culture, teas were a part of what they drank as well. And the teas were, you know, more of an herbal tea. They were poor people and they'd have to make their own. And so, you know, using some of the local plants or that they would create their own teas, but mostly it was water. And once again, I think there's a lesson there for us is water really is the perfect drink. I mean, assuming of course it's clean and pure, and water can heal us. Now, one thing about their water is that because they lived in there were a lot of these limestone caves everywhere, their water was a very hard water, meaning that it was very high in, for example, magnesium, very high in calcium. It was like I said, a very hard, mineral dense water. And then there's certainly some studies on that about the importance of the waters that you drink. And so they were fortunate. They were in a perfect geographic location.
Yeah, that's awesome. I wish we had access to that kind of mineral water readily. We do have hard water out here, but it's not magnesium. Talk about motion. I mean, you kind of mentioned it, and maybe there's not much more to say on that. They're just active. They get up, they eat, and then they go to the fields, they work, and they work some more, and whatever they pick that morning, they eat for lunch. Whatever they pick that afternoon, they eat for dinner, and they socialize in the evening. So they're just in this constant motion.
Absolutely. And I think you covered it right there. Is, you know, they weren't sitting at their desks all day long. You know, they weren't sitting in front of their TVs in the evenings. They were out moving. Now, of course, they did sit down and socialize in the evenings after a hard day's work, but they were in constant motion. And in hand farming, they would work all of their muscle groups. They were incredibly healthy and things didn't hurt. It was low impact, but they were in constant motion all day long. It wasn't sitting at their computer for 12 hours a day and then on the weekend, you know, hitting it hard and then getting a physical injury. They were just well trained.
Right. And we've talked on our show before about all the studies that have come out to show that that 45-minute workout at the gym at the end of the day doesn't erase all the damaging effects of sitting for 8 hours or 9 or 10 or 12 hours. It's that constant sitting motion that really does the damage. The thought that hit me when you were saying all the stuff they're doing, hand farming, you know, we blame so much on wear and tear. Your arthritis is just wear and tear, all these years of taking a beating, taking a pounding, which I'm not saying there's not something to be said for trauma from maybe, you know, professional sports, or we've got rodeo cowboys out here on Buck and Bronx that I'm not saying there can't be trauma, but this general notion that all these arthritic patients are just wear and tear, there's not much validity to that when you think about what these guys are doing hand farming all these years.
I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. It's, our body has a remarkable way of healing itself. Now, of course, you don't want to overdo things. There are definitely overuse injuries and getting bucked off a horse. You can definitely have trauma. But provided your range of activities, you're varying them through the days, through the years, you're not overdoing things, the body is built. It has a repair mechanism inside of it. And I completely agree. I mean, for years, I guess like everyone else, I used to run a lot of marathons, but everyone would tell me, don't run marathons. You're going to wear out your knees, this and that. But, you know, if you dig into the medical literature, I mean, these are Western medical studies and prestigious medical journals that provided you are doing everything right, you're not overweight, so you're not overtaxing your joints and that long-term runners don't have any increased risk of knee injuries in people who don't run. So provided you do it in a smart, healthy, sensible way, your body will take care of you.
Yeah, and I want to just remind our listeners, we've talked about it before, but the body regenerates all the time. Your cells die all the time, and you make new ones all the time. But the cells need the raw materials to be able to build a new cell that fully functions the right way. And when it comes to these joints and the cartilage that line the joints and the cells that line your bones and your joints, there's little tiny blood vessels that feed these spaces. And inflammation will impede good blood flow and good oxygenation and nutrient delivery to those pieces of cartilage. So again, going back to inflammation is at the root of so much of this. And if you keep good blood flow through those tiny little blood vessels that feed your cartilage, that's a big part of it, which of course, diet and lifestyle is how you avoid that inflammation. Dr. Day, could you kind of, we probably have about 10 minutes left and I still want to hit a lot of things that we probably won't get to, but I want to definitely give you a chance to summarize, some of these chapters. One is called Master Your Mindset. Another one, chapter three, Build Your Place in a Positive Community, and Find Your Rhythm. And just this sense of how you live your life and your outlook on life and your interaction with others in your world and your sphere, and just kind of your thoughts, your thought process. Can you speak to that and how important you think that is in relationship to the eating, drinking, and moving? It seemed to be a pretty big part of your belief here that your thoughts and your involvement in your environment and your community was a pretty big deal.
Absolutely. And with regards to mindset, as we touched on it briefly, is these centenarians lived, they had tough lives. You know, all of the years of famine under failed Chairman Mao policies, civil war, etc. But they always had this positive mindset. They were grateful people. And they didn't, their mindset was such, and perhaps some of it was shaped by their environment, is, you know, they didn't go to bed at night worried and stressed out, probably because they were too tired to be worried or stressed out. So they just slept at night. But there's something very powerful about having an optimistic outlook. And I will say that even these centenarians, you would think that as being a centenarian, you'd be thinking that, oh, life's just going to get worse. But they all felt like their life was going to get better. Their health was going to, everything was going to get better with time. And in fact, many, many, many studies show that optimists live longer. They have less chronic medical conditions and they heal better, whether it's a placebo effect or there's some activation at the cellular level, genetic level. We don't fully know, but having that positive mindset, optimizing stress levels is huge. And so that mindset is very important. That's why we set a chapter on it. With regards to community, this is something that a lot of us don't think about, but there are many studies out there, and there's some brilliant researchers, and we cite a lot of this work in our book. But in looking at it, if you look at large population studies, there have been a number of researchers that have shown that loneliness or social isolation is a bigger risk factor for a premature death or disability than either smoking or obesity. We are designed to be social creatures, and we need that. And maybe that's some of what's behind a lot of the anxiety and stress that we have in our modern lives, is we've lost a lot of those social ties that held our societies together through millennia. But we have to have that sense of belonging, that sense of purpose, somebody who cares about us. And there's something very powerful that happens for our health when that occurs. We also talked a little bit about rhythm, being a doctor who specializes in heart rhythms. I had to dedicate a chapter to that, but having a circadian rhythm, going to bed, waking up at the same time, getting natural sunlight during the day, avoiding or minimizing artificial light at night, meal timing. These are all things that we're just learning in studies now that indeed are very important to health and longevity that these people just knew naturally. Once again, they didn't set out intentionally to do that. A lot of it was just because of their circumstances in life. But that is all part of this secret sauce to health and longevity. And just touch on a couple of the others. Environment. Of course, when we think of environment, you want clean food, clean water, clean air. And these people had it, which is a little bit unique for China. But in addition to that, they were in an environment where they weren't tempted by all these processed foods. They didn't go to take their kids to a soccer game, and then once their kids run around a little bit, pump them full of donuts and you know, whatever sugary beverages to go with it. They didn't have that. They weren't tempted by all of these foods that are harmful for our health. Maybe they would take over a plate of vegetables to their neighbor, sharing of their garden. So something there, avoiding all these temptations. And so often people say to me, Dr. Day, you know, I wish I had the willpower that these people in China that you studied have. They don't have any more willpower than we do. It's just that they lived in an environment that was free from all these temptations. And that's one of the big secrets to implementing this in the West, is to create an environment where you don't have all these temptations. Get rid of all the junk food in your house. If it's not there, you're probably not going to eat it. And so that is one of the key aspects to it. And then the last one is a sense of purpose. And we know purpose is important. People who have a sense of purpose live a lot longer. They have a lot less cardiovascular disease and other diseases and ailments. And the same was true with these people. All of the centenarians that we met were still working 7 days a week, every day of the year, except taking about a week off around the Chinese New Year time. Now, they're no longer out working in the fields just because society has changed, but rather they're meeting and greeting and sharing their life experiences with these busloads of people that would come through these villages that are all in this longevity belt in China and share of their experience and give their advice. And when we would talk with them, why are you still doing this? They felt the sense of belonging, that their family needed them, that they were still providing for their family, even though it may have been, you know, fourth or fifth generation now. And of course, they would get these donations from these people who would travel, and they felt needed. They felt a part of their families. And so that was something that struck me as well. They didn't put their older people out and isolated them, but rather they were still contributing and they felt needed. And when you put all of these things that we've discussed together today, you get a very long life free from all of these diseases. And it's not just these people in China. Studies show that our genes, most people, now not everyone, but most people have been given the genes to allow them to live to approximately age 90 in good health. And we can achieve 90 great years of health as long as we don't screw it up. And so our genes are there. We can do it. And if you're lucky, maybe you'll hit 100. But we are all, or most of us, have the opportunity of 90 excellent years of life.
Yeah, that's awesome. Very encouraging and fascinating. And you do mention a lot of studies through the book. I'd encourage people to get the book and read it, because you will be encouraged. One study I wrote down, 516 people, all were greater than 90 years old. They had a gene for elevated homocysteine, which is a kind of a marker we look at for cardiovascular disease. Increases your risk for heart attacks and Alzheimer's, but none of the people had heart attacks or Alzheimer's in that study. Another study showed 267 people, average age of 88 years old, only one had dementia. That's 0.4% compared to the United States, where it'd be 50%. So you do a lot of these comparisons of the U.S., like coronary artery disease, 17-fold higher rates, breast cancer, 10 times more breast cancer here in the States, dementia, 3-fold. So I love that part of it, too, for those folks who need to see the science. There's a lot of that in the book, too. So you and your wife, Jane Ann, how have y'all implemented this personally or professionally? Are you able to practice in a way that implements some of this? I know most Americans are just looking for a quick fix. Give me a stent or zap my heart or give me a pill. Have you been able to change your practice any? Have you changed your home, your environment, your family in the few minutes?
Absolutely.
We have just a couple minutes left. I'm sorry.
All right. So
we have to cram this in.
My practice, as I mentioned, 80% of cardiovascular diseases, at least 80% of lifestyle related. And so when I see a new patient with atrial fibrillation, maybe they have coronary artery disease, diabetes, hypertension as well, we start off first in trying to optimize their lifestyle. Lifestyle optimization, incredible results. And at least in my area of expertise in atrial fibrillation, we find, and now studies are coming out showing that at least 50% of the people can put their cardiovascular disease into remission just with lifestyle optimization alone. For those who were not able to put it into remission with lifestyle optimization, then yes, we may look at either medications or other procedures, but then maintaining that lifestyle optimization can prevent it from coming back. I mean, yes, I can go into the heart, I can map out where the heart is misfiring, zap it, get rid of it. But if they don't change what their underlying lifestyle, it's just going to come right back. Same thing with, say, cavities in the mouth. The dentist can drill and fill, but if you don't change what you're eating, it's just a matter of time and it's going to come back. In our home, it's a little bit trickier. We have four children. I have two teenagers, two younger than that. And it's hard because they are influenced by these sugary foods, processed foods, and it hijacks their taste buds. We do the best we can. You know, we're not immune. We don't have a perfect family, but we try to lead by example and then to always have healthy food available. Always have the veggies cut up, ready to go, so that there's no effort there for them. And with the right example and making healthy food as convenient as humanly possible, and then trying to make the junk as difficult to get to as possible, I think we're making some headway, but it's hard. It's hard when they go to friends' house or school events or sporting events, and it's all around them. But we're doing the best we can, and that's really all we can do. We are all on this journey. We are all on at different phases of the journey, and all we can do is just do the best that we can.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think that's a great way to end the show. It's not about being perfect. It's about doing the best you can, but being intentional about it. And like you said, make the good stuff easy and the bad stuff hard. Keep that the sugary processed stuff far away as possible. That's what we do in our home with our six children. But your book is so encouraging because it really pushes back against the notion that I think most Americans are still under this mindset of my genes are everything and there's nothing I can do about it. These diseases just come from my genes and all I can do is a pharmaceutical or medical intervention. And like you said, sometimes that's necessary, especially if they can't or won't address the diet and lifestyle. Or sometimes there's just some permanent damage from 20 or 30 or 50 years of the wrong diet and lifestyle. But do your medical intervention to kind of save the day if it's more emergent, but definitely still get after your diet and lifestyle. Even if you're 70 years old, the body's so amazing and resilient, it can still reverse or put things into remission. So I encourage everyone to get after it and get Dr. Day's book for sure. Dr. Jane Day and his wife, John Day and Jane Day. That's a little bit confusing there. But also his website, drjohnday.com. A lot of good stuff on there, talking about reversing AFib and reversing heart disease and the success stories there. So it's awesome the work you're doing, Dr. Day. I really, really appreciate your work and the energy and time you and your wife both have spent to make this available to everybody. I know I reference it daily. I'm sure many physicians around the country do also. So thanks for all you've done. Thank you for the hour of your time you've given us today. It's going to be very beneficial to lots of folks out here in West Texas.
Oh, thank you so much, and thanks for having me on, and I've enjoyed this conversation, Ben.
All right. Well, everyone, that's Dr. John Day. Thanks for joining us on You're the Cure. We'll be back next week with another great show.